Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Monday, May 17th, 2021. Glad you're with us. President Joe Biden announcing the U.S. will be sending at least 20 million more coronavirus vaccine doses overseas by the end of June from Pfizer, Moderna, or Johnson & Johnson. This is in addition to the 60 million AstraZeneca doses already pledged to other countries for a total of 80 million. President saying, "We know America will never be fully safe until the pandemic that's raging globally is under control." The Supreme Court agrees to hear a major challenge to the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision that legalized abortion. It involves a Mississippi law that bans most abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy, with limited exceptions. The key issue: when does fetal viability begin? We'll get the latest from a Bloomberg News Supreme Court reporter. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says the U.S. will not join for an immediate ceasefire call between Israel and the Palestinian Hamas as the fierce fighting enters a second week. More than 200 people killed, most of them Palestinians. Biden administration says millions of American families will start getting direct cash payments in July under a new child benefit created by the coronavirus economic aid bill. And it is federal tax day, the usual deadline of April 15th, extended 1 month. Residents of three states, though, that experienced severe winter storms have some more time. Texas, Oklahoma, and Louisiana have until June 15th to file with the IRS. This from the Washington Post. President Biden said Monday the number of coronavirus cases are down in all 50 states for the first time since the pandemic began, as he announced plans for the U.S. to share more U.S.-approved coronavirus vaccines abroad with the goal of, as he put it, ending the pandemic everywhere. President Biden spoke from the White House.
Let me talk to another milestone on a long battle with COVID. Today, for the first time since the pandemic began, pandemic cases are down in all 50 states. First time. That's right. Thanks a lot to the hard work of so many people, COVID cases are down in all 50 states. Now, I can't promise that will continue this way. We know there will be advances and setbacks. And we know that there are many flare-ups that could occur. But if the unvaccinated get vaccinated, they will protect themselves and other unvaccinated people around them. If they do not, states with low vaccination rates may see those rates go up, may see this progress reversed. Ultimately, those who are not vaccinated will end up paying the price. The vaccinated will continue to be protected against severe illnesses, but others may not be if you're not vaccinated. But given that the vaccination is convenient and free, it'll be a tragedy and a needless one to see COVID cases among those who do not get vaccinated go up. We're not done fighting this virus. We still have tens of millions left to vaccinate. But we are making significant progress. In fact, when tomorrow's vaccination numbers come out, they'll show that 60% of the Americans have received at least one shot. Every day, the light at the end of that tunnel is growing brighter. This vaccination effort has been a historic logistical achievement for our nation. And I want to thank the scientists and the researchers, the companies manufacturing the vaccines, the National Guard, the U.S. military, FEMA, the nation's governors, doctors, nurses, pharmacists. I want to thank the American people who have stepped up and done their patriotic duty and gotten vaccinated.
President Biden saying 60% of Americans have gotten at least one coronavirus vaccine shot. About 35% are fully vaccinated. That's over 117 million people. But with many of the unvaccinated not rushing to get shots, vaccine supply will soon start to exceed demand in the U.S. And now, for the first time, President Biden saying that some doses of COVID-19 vaccines that have already been approved for emergency use in the U.S., that would be Pfizer, Moderna, and J&J, will be sent to other countries.
Now, over the past 118 days, our vaccinations program has led the world. And today, we're taking an additional step to help the world. We know America will never be fully safe until the pandemic that's raging globally is under control. No oceans wide enough, no walls high enough to keep us safe. Rampant disease and death in other countries can destabilize them, those countries, and pose a risk to us as well. New variants could arise overseas that could put us at greater risk. And we need to help fight the disease around the world to keep us safe here at home and to do the right thing of helping other people. It's the right thing to do. It's the smart thing to do. It's the strong thing to do. In March, we shared over 4 million doses of our AstraZeneca vaccine with Canada and Mexico. At the end of April, we announced that we would provide another 60 million doses of our AstraZeneca vaccine overseas. Remember, this is the vaccine that's not authorized for use in the United States yet, so we're going to be sending it to folks once the FDA has reviewed this and said it's safe. This is all the AstraZeneca vaccine produced in the United States. All of it will be sent to other countries. And today, I'm announcing they will also share U.S.-authorized vaccine doses of Pfizer and Moderna and Johnson & Johnson as they become available with the rest of the world as well. These are vaccinations and vaccines that are authorized to be put in arms of Americans. And by the end of June, when we will have taken delivery of enough of such vaccines to protect everyone in the United States will share at least 20 million of those doses, that extra supply, with other countries. This means over the next 6 weeks, the United States of America will send 80 million doses overseas. That represents 13% of the vaccines produced by the United States by the end of June. This will be more vaccines than any country has actually shared to date, 5 times more than any other country, more than Russia, China, which have donated 15 million doses. You know, there's a lot of talk about Russia and China influencing the world with vaccines. We want to lead the world with our values, with this demonstration of our innovation and ingenuity and the fundamental decency of the American people.
President Biden at the White House. Earlier this Monday, the Director General of the World Health Organization, the man known as Dr. Tedros, called for greater vaccine sharing. He said, quote, "There is a huge disconnect growing where in some countries with the highest vaccination rates, there appears to be a mindset that the pandemic is over, while others are experiencing huge waves of infection." Many of the headlines about implementing the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention guidance from last week on when you don't have to wear a mask if you're fully vaccinated, those headlines are using a common word, confusion. CDC says fully vaccinated Americans do not need to wear masks or socially distance indoors or outdoors with some exceptions. But questions remain about whether proof of vaccination should be required. What about policies of private businesses that serve the public, like restaurants and stores? Former Surgeon General Jerome Adams asked about this on Fox News.
The CDC, sir, is under a lot of fire. Do they deserve to be for this confusion that people feel in terms of the communications of how this is being rolled out?
Well, great question, and I understand why people are confused. I want everyone to know the science behind this is sound. We know that cases are going down, vaccinations are going up, and there's been recent research to show that these vaccinations are incredibly effective, greater than 90% effective at lowering spread, and they work against variants. The CDC made the right play call, but they fumbled the ball at the one-yard line. The communication was just, quite frankly, abysmal on this. I heard from public health officials, and Dana, you know I used to run a state health department. My buddies all called me up and said, oh my gosh, what is going on here? We were completely blindsided by this. There was no nuance. And again, you've got whiplash from last week to this week. So I think there needs to be some improvement in communication, but the science is sound.
The governors that Nebraska, New Hampshire, they were all confused. Nobody really had a heads up. You kind of want that line of communication, don't you, to make sure that people have a plan in place. Washington Post characterized it this way. If such a head-scratching turn of events had occurred under former President Donald Trump, the administration surely would have blamed for the lack of coordination and a resulting widespread confusion. Well, you were there at the White House then. Guilty as charged on that?
Well, we want to learn from our mistakes. And one of the things that has continually happened, and I'm wearing my Ebola necktie right now, this goes back to Ebola. There was very poor communication about new guidance from the CDC to state and local officials. It's continued to happen, and it's frustrating to me to see it continue to happen under this administration, because people lose trust in the public health system when they go to their public health official. And I literally heard this from a public health official. They were in a press conference and got asked a question about CDC guidance and had to honestly say, what CDC guidance?
Dr. Jerome Adams was Surgeon General under President Trump, 2017 through the end of the term, January 20th, 2021. He spoke with Fox News Monday morning. More states making their decisions about how to respond to the CDC guidance on masks. California, their health officials saying their mask mandate will remain in place until the state fully opens, and that would be June 15th. But in New York, Governor Andrew Cuomo says his state will follow the CDC guidance sooner and deal with that on Wednesday. People will not have to wear masks according to that guidance. It is federal tax day, and White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki says that President Biden's tax returns will be released, in her word, soon. She said, stay tuned. Releasing those tax returns would reinstate the presidential transition, a tradition that was stopped by former President Donald Trump. Jen Psaki also encouraging people to file a federal tax return, even if you owe nothing, because of the potential refundable tax credits and a new benefit announced today.
Filing also ensures people get all the refundable tax credits they may be eligible for, like the earned income tax credit, the child and the child tax credit. And today, Treasury and the IRS announced that starting in July, the American Rescue Plan will deliver critical tax relief to middle-class and hard-pressed working families with children. The first monthly payments of the expanded child tax credit will be made on July 15th to 39 million households, covering more than 88% of children in the United States. These payments will be made on the 15th of each month, unless the 15th falls on a weekend or holiday, allowing families who receive the credit by direct deposit to plan their budgets more effectively. And eligible families will receive a monthly payment of up to $300 per month for each child under the age of six, and up to $250 per month for each child age six until the year they turn over age six, sorry, till the year they turn 18. More than 80% of the 39 million households will receive the child tax credit by direct deposit to ensure safe and fast delivery.
An article in the Washington Post begins, the Biden administration announced Monday that roughly 39 million American families will begin receiving direct cash payments in July under a new child benefit created by Democrats' coronavirus relief bill. Joining us now is the author, the Post White House economics reporter, Jeff Stein. Thanks so much for doing this. Who qualifies for this benefit and how much will the families get?
So, as you mentioned, in March, Biden and the Democratic Congress approved a $1.9 trillion stimulus that had this new child benefit. The administration says that essentially 88% of all American children live in households that will qualify for this benefit and start receiving it. Particularly worth noting is that the benefit diminishes for people who are higher earners, individuals with an AGI, adjusted gross income, of over $75,000, as well as couples over $150K. They'll see smaller benefits or no benefit at all. But for everyone below that threshold, which is the vast majority of families in the U.S., this is a substantial amount of money, $250 per kid per month for kids aged 6 to 17, and then $300 per month for kids 0 to 6. A big expansion of an existing program, a child tax credit, but also changing its scope and how it operates, both to include the benefit in full to poor families who were previously shut out of the program, as well as to have the IRS send it monthly directly into people's bank accounts.
How different and significant is that approach, sending the monthly checks?
Well, it's one of the most important changes in the law, that the Democrats approved just for 1 year. But, Democrats say that families, low-income families in particular, deal with income shocks. There's a lot of job churn at the bottom of the income distribution. People fall into and out of work much more quickly than at the top. And as a result, having this money appearing regularly sort of smooths out those income shocks and makes sure that there's at least something coming in when mean times arrive. There are significant implementation challenges, in part because of Democrats' desire to means test the benefit to prevent the richest people from benefiting from it. That, helped get this program through Congress, but it's going to make it quite burdensome administratively. It means that families, including poor families, have to fill out quite a bit more paperwork, especially if they don't already file income taxes. It's very hard for the IRS to find them. I saw an estimate today that said about half of children who live in deep poverty, severe poverty, are in households that don't regularly file income taxes, and they could miss out if the IRS is not able to reach them.
You mentioned that this has been authorized for 1 year. Democrats looking to extend that?
Yes, it's kind of an ironic moment because the president has been saying that he wants to make this permanently, but the White House's own policy proposals have only proposed doing so through 2025. They have been skittish about embracing too much spending. They don't want to come out and say we're doing it, you know, we're proposing an additional X dollars in spending. So to mitigate that, they've only proposed extending the program through 2025, even though they are simultaneously saying that they would like this to be made permanent. One of the weird ways that budget math in Washington works, can be a lot of incentive to play games with some of these numbers.
We're talking with Jeff Stein of The Washington Post. You also write this, that the new program represents one of the most important Biden domestic policy initiatives and could have significant political consequences as the White House seeks to reshape the U.S. economy. What consequences are you talking about?
Well, I think it's worth noting just quickly here, not just, you know, as you're right, but I did say that, but, you know, the story talks about in America, we have among the highest child poverty rates in the world for developed nations, in part because we spend so little compared to our peers on helping, you know, families with children. And, I don't pretend to be a political expert, but a lot of Democrats, the White House and others are saying providing direct cash material benefits. We saw a lot of evidence in the polls that Trump really saw political advantage, particularly from people who don't pay that close attention to the news, from sending out those stimulus payments that amounted to a really big boost to a lot of low-income families. Biden is kind of taking a little bit from that and saying maybe there's political upside to delivering these monthly, effectively, you know, stimulus checks for parents on a smaller level. As we come out of COVID, the stimulus checks are unlikely to be reauthorized. But this could be part of their permanent lasting legacy, that Democrats saw the political upside from sending money directly into people's bank accounts. And if the public is grateful, which is there's a lot of reason to believe they will be, for this program, then you know, it could help Democrats in the midterms. Alternatively, of course, if there are glitches in the program, if people, as may be the case, have to pay back some of the money if they're incorrectly given too much at tax time, that could be a real political nightmare for the party and could hurt Democrats in 2022.
Washington Post White House economics reporter Jeff Stein. Read his work at WashingtonPost.com or follow him on Twitter at @JStein_WAPO. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
On Wall Street, the Dow was down 54, NASDAQ down 50, S&P down 10. A new Gallup poll says 72% of white-collar workers are still working from home after more than a year of the pandemic. In some fields, top 80% still working from home, including computer-oriented or mathematical fields and life, physical, and social sciences, also arts, design, entertainment, and media. Federal Reserve survey released today showing nearly one-fourth of Americans ended 2020 worse off financially than they were 12 months ago. Fuel outages persisting in parts of the southeast United States, and the national gas price average remains at its highest level in 6 years, $3.04 a gallon, even as the Colonial Pipeline has resumed operations following last week's ransomware attack. AAA saying a price increase in gas leading up to Memorial Day weekend was expected, but last week's shutdown caused prices to surge in the weeks ahead of the holiday. The U.S. Senate is taking up a bill to authorize more than $100 billion over 5 years for technology research. The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says the Endless Frontier Act, as it is known, is needed to make the U.S. competitive again against world competition, including and especially China.
Last week, the Senate Commerce Committee voted to, on an overwhelmingly bipartisan basis, 24-4, to advance the bill. The Endless Frontiers Act will form the core of what will be a comprehensive bill to boost America's ability to compete, innovate, and win to the technologies of the 21st century. Over the course of the next week or two, the Senate will debate and amend the legislation. I look forward to having another open and bipartisan amendment process, just as we did on the Asian Hate Crimes Bill and the bipartisan Water Infrastructure Bill. There is no reason, no reason the Senate can't finish our work on this important legislation by the end of the month. Members on both sides of the aisle know that decades of federal underinvestment in science and technology have imperiled America's global economic leadership. When we invest in science, it inevitably produces millions of good-paying jobs. So this comprehensive bill will boost funding for basic scientific research, tech development, and manufacturing. It'll strengthen our alliances and partnerships abroad. It'll fortify weak spots in our economy, like semiconductors, and will ensure that we hold the Chinese Communist Party accountable for its predatory economic practices. It's a forward-looking, comprehensive plan to preserve America's competitive edge. The benefits will be manifold. When we invest in scientific research, the effect is diffusive. It helps our universities, our laboratories, and our businesses. And again, it creates new good-paying jobs, millions of them, millions of them. So if you're looking for the future, and our people want to have a brighter future, and want to be assured that their children will have better-paying jobs than they have, this is an answer, one of the most important answers we can come up with. An American workforce will help bring American inventions to the global market, and the way we have been number one in the economy for the last century will continue on into this one.
The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, on the Senate floor. This bill has already been changed by the Commerce Committee since it was introduced. Originally, it had $100 billion for a new technology directorate at the National Science Foundation that focused on emerging technologies. But that amount was reduced to $30 billion by the committee. Instead, the bulk of the funding for basic advanced research would be funneled through the Energy Department. You can follow the Senate live, gavel to gavel, on C-SPAN 2 television or listen on the free C-SPAN radio app. Washington Today continues in a minute. And welcome back to Washington Today. A few more headlines. Former President Donald Trump plans to speak at the North Carolina Republican State Convention on June 5th. He won North Carolina in the 2020 presidential race by just over one percentage point. His daughter, Lara, has not ruled out running for a U.S. Senate seat in the state in 2022. And of course, former President Trump has not ruled out running for president again in 2024. And Georgia's Lieutenant Governor Jeff Duncan, who was one of the top Republican critics of Donald Trump's efforts to overturn Joe Biden's win in Georgia, today announcing he is not going to run for re-election next year. From the Associated Press, the Israeli military unleashed another heavy wave of airstrikes Monday on the Gaza Strip, saying it destroyed militant tunnels and the homes of nine Hamas commanders. International diplomacy to end the week-long war that has killed hundreds appears to make little headway. Israel has said it will press on for now with attacks against Hamas, the militant group that rules Gaza, and the United States signaled it would not pressure the two sides for a ceasefire. President Biden asked why.
Mr. President, do you not insist upon a ceasefire given the escalation in violence we've seen over the weekend?
I'll be speaking with the Prime Minister in an hour, and I'll be able to talk to you after that. Thank you.
President Biden at the White House. AFP has a story. The United States on Monday blocked for the third time in a week the adoption of a joint UN Security Council statement calling for a halt to Israeli-Palestinian violence and the protection of civilians. The text draft was by China, Tunisia, and Norway, submitted late Sunday for approval Monday by the Council's 15 members. More on this position from Secretary of State Antony Blinken, questioned by reporters Monday morning during his visit to Denmark.
We have been working around the clock through diplomatic channels to try to bring an end to the conflict. As you know, President Biden was on the phone with Prime Minister Netanyahu, President Abbas, 24 hours ago. And on Saturday, I've spoken to both of them. As I mentioned, coming over here, I spent most of the time on the plane actually calling various counterparts, Egypt, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, as well as my French counterpart. And there'll be more such conversations later today. We've had a whole series of senior officials, starting as well with our Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, working with her counterparts, Deputy Secretary of State Sherman as well. Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, and of course we have our senior official for Israel-Palestine affairs, Hadi Amer, on the ground in Israel now. In all of these engagements, We've made clear that we are prepared to lend our support and good offices to the parties should they seek a ceasefire. And that's precisely the message I think you heard from Ambassador Thomas Greenfield during the UN session yesterday. Any diplomatic initiative that advances that prospect is something that that we'll support. And we are, again, willing and ready to do that. But ultimately, it is up to the parties to make clear that they want to pursue a ceasefire. Any ceasefire would be, by definition, between them, but we are ready to engage to support it. Meanwhile, we are working tirelessly across every diplomatic channel we have to advance the prospect of getting to calm and ending the violence.
Does that mean the United Nations Security Council does not help that process of de-escalation, and that's why the U.S. isn't supporting it? Or correct me if I'm misunderstanding.
No. We're not, standing in the way of diplomacy. The contrary, we're exercising it virtually nonstop. The question is, will any given action, any given statement actually, as a practical matter, advance the prospects for ending the violence or not? And that's the judgment we have to make each time. If we think that there's something, including at the United Nations, that would effectively advance that, we would be for it. We thought it was very important the other day to have this open discussion where the parties could put forward their views, their concerns, and be heard. And we'll continue to look for ways to advance the goal that that we have, which is ending the violence.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Copenhagen, a joint news conference with the Danish foreign minister. Blinken is touring Nordic countries this week. It's unrelated to the Middle East conflict specifically. Some background on this now week-long conference from Reuters. Hamas began its rocket assault last Monday after weeks of tensions over a court case to evict several Palestinian families in East Jerusalem, and in retaliation for Israeli police clashes with Palestinians near the city's Al-Aqsa Mosque, Islam's third holiest site during the Muslim holy months of Ramadan. Palestinians have also become frustrated by setbacks to their aspirations for an independent state and to an end to Israeli occupation in recent years. That was from Reuters. Israel says it has been targeting weapon smuggling tunnels and certain buildings in Gaza used by Hamas. One building brought down over the weekend had offices as well from media outlets, including the Associated Press and Al Jazeera. Here again is Secretary of State Blinken.
The Prime Minister of Israel and officials from the IDF said over the weekend that they've transmitted intelligence to the United States that shows Hamas was using that tower they struck in Gaza to house military assets. As you know, it also housed several media organizations who lost their offices and equipment and archives. Have you seen that intelligence? Has it been transmitted? And did you find it credible?
So let me start by saying, I think, as you know, I had the opportunity over the weekend before leaving to speak to the president and CEO of the AP, Gary Pruitt. We had what I thought was a good, very good conversation, and I wanted to speak to him and as well as to all of you to reaffirm the strong commitment of the United States, the unwavering support of the United States for independent journalists and media organizations around the world, including for their safety and security. I think independent journalism is especially important in conflict zones. I made a similar point earlier this month when we marked World Press Freedom Day, and I had the opportunity then to speak to journalists from around the world who, like so many of you, are pursuing the truth at sometimes at great risk. And that's something I take very much to heart. So when it comes to the strike in Gaza, I was relieved that no one from the journalism community in that strike was hurt, and people were able to leave the building safely. As you know, I think President Biden and other members of the administration have raised directly our concerns with our Israeli counterparts about the safety and security of journalists operating in Gaza. And we have stressed the need for their protection. Shortly after the strike, we did request additional details regarding the justification for it. I wouldn't want to weigh in on intelligence matters in this forum. It's not my place. I will leave it to others to characterize if any information has been shared and our assessment of that information. The broader point, though, remains, and this is really critical. Israel has a special responsibility to protect civilians in the course of its self-defense, and that most certainly includes journalists.
You said that you requested additional information. Mm-hmm. Have you received it? Have you seen it? And did you find it credible?
I've not seen any information provided. And again, to the extent that it is based on intelligence, that would have been shared with other colleagues, and I'll leave that to them to assess.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Back to the call from some for a ceasefire. More than two dozen U.S. Democratic senators, led by John Ossoff of Georgia, writing a letter to President Biden this weekend. And separately, a bipartisan letter from Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut and Republican Senator Todd Young of Indiana. Monday afternoon, Senator Murphy spoke on the Senate floor in Washington.
The Israelis were wrong to pursue settlements and evictions as a deliberate means to undermine a future Palestinian state. These policies might have helped hold together Netanyahu's political coalition, but they helped feed a sense of hopelessness amongst Palestinians and their future. The Palestinian leadership was wrong to perpetuate an anti-Israeli, anti-Semitic narrative as a foundation of their hold on power. They were wrong to choose grievance over diplomacy. But, Madam President, the United States, over the last 4 years, we played a role too. President Trump rejected America's historic role as a broker for peace and reconciliation between Israelis and Palestinians. He chose a side unconditionally, and his alliance with Netanyahu and his rejection of a Palestinian state drove the two parties further apart and turned the temperature up. Trump pursued a path to intentionally create division rather than healing. And those 4 years of America's absence from his traditional post of mediator is also a big reason of why we are here today. So there's going to be time to talk about the big picture, to talk about what went wrong, how American policy needs to change towards Israel and the West Bank and Gaza. But right now, our focus needs to be laser-like on de-escalation, on a ceasefire. Hamas must stop its rocket attacks. They are war crimes. They are indiscriminate. They do nothing to help the Palestinians in East Jerusalem or anywhere else. And Israel needs to stand down its military campaign as well. Have to take off the table a ground invasion of Gaza. Israel possesses disproportionate military power. That's why during the 2014 invasion of Gaza, 2,000 Palestinians died compared with less than 100 Israelis. But when children die in Gaza, it does nothing to secure Israel. In fact, it does the opposite. It just provides further fuel to this furnace of grievances. So I'm glad that the administration is sending Deputy Assistant Secretary Amer to the region, that he's there. It's critical that we also get a formal U.S. ambassador to Israel in place as quickly as possible. But the United States needs to be pressing for a ceasefire. The United States can't afford to simply allow for this escalation to continue. That's not in Israel's best interest. That's not in America's best interest. And my hope is that in the conversations that are happening today between the Biden administration and the Netanyahu government, that they are talking about the terms to bring this violence to an end.
Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat from Connecticut, on the Senate floor. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, Democrat of Minnesota, responding to reports the Biden administration plans to sell precision-guided weapons to Israel. Congresswoman Omar writing, it would be appalling for the administration to go through $735 million in precision-guided weaponry to Netanyahu without any strings attached in the wake of escalating violence and attacks on civilians. She's referring to the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Congresswoman Omar goes on, if this goes through, this will be seen as a green light for continued escalation and will undercut any attempts at brokering a ceasefire. Congresswoman Omar is one of the first Muslim women to be elected to Congress. This is Washington Today. The U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to hear arguments in a major abortion case that challenges a law in Mississippi. We spoke with Greg Storr, Supreme Court reporter with Bloomberg News, and asked him what this case is about.
This case is Mississippi's bid to revive a law that would ban abortion in almost all cases after 15 weeks of pregnancy. Mississippi is asking the court to say that this line of fetal viability, in other words, this moment when a fetus could potentially live outside the womb, that line has been the defining feature of the Supreme Court's abortion rights jurisprudence, where it said states cannot regulate abortion before that point. Mississippi is asking the Supreme Court to throw out that line and allow states to restrict abortion much earlier during a pregnancy.
You describe the possibility that this law is upheld as gutting the constitutional right to abortion. Is it really that big potentially?
It is certainly that big potentially. As I said, viability is what everyone has based their laws on and lower courts have based their rulings on ever since the 1992 Casey decision and really going back to the 1973 Roe v. Wade ruling. Mississippi says the Supreme Court doesn't have to overturn those rulings in order to uphold the state's law, but it says it would be okay with it if the Supreme Court did that. States are lining up. There have been dozens of new laws enacted this year in conservative states restricting abortion, including a couple states that have enacted outright bans. If the Supreme Court sides with Mississippi, it is entirely possible that the next case that comes before the Supreme Court will be a case that seeks to defend an outright ban on abortion.
And it has been noted this is the first major abortion case with all three of now former President Donald Trump's appointees. How does that affect the potential ruling?
It could make all the difference in the world. The court has been very closely divided in abortion cases in recent years. Justice Ginsburg died, Chief Justice John Roberts was sort of the pivotal point for the court. Justice Ginsburg, of course, was an ardent abortion rights supporter. With Amy Coney Barrett now on the court in her seat, we have seen then-Judge Barrett suggest that she was open to abortion restrictions as a lower court judge. If indeed she proves to be receptive to restrictions as a Supreme Court justice, it would shift the balance of the court and potentially mean a victory for Mississippi.
We're speaking with Greg Storr with Bloomberg News. In terms of timing, when will the oral argument be and when could we expect a decision?
It will be late this year. We don't have an exact date. It probably will be something like November, and odds are the decision will come at the very end of the next Supreme Court term, so maybe June of 2022, and that would set it up to be both abortion and the Supreme Court to be very big issues in the midterm elections next year.
And finally, when we're looking at the merits of this case, is it simply come down to whether you support abortion or oppose abortion, or in this argument about fetal viability, have conditions changed in the past couple of decades that I'm not too sure if I'm asking this correctly? You know, how is this argument being presented?
Well, conditions have changed in that fetuses can live earlier and earlier outside the womb. One of the issues with viability is it's a bit of a moving target. And part of what Mississippi is arguing is that states should be allowed to change their laws as medicine changes. Exactly how that will factor in with the Supreme Court is hard to say. It may be that the court says it's hard to base a constitutional principle over the kind of line that is going to be moving, and so that might be a reason for tossing it out.
Greg Storr is a Supreme Court reporter with Bloomberg News. Find his stories at Bloomberg.com and follow him on Twitter at Greg Storr. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Supreme Court issued a ruling today, 6-3, the justices ruling that a previous decision holding that the Constitution requires unanimous jury verdicts for state criminal trials does not apply retroactively. From CNN, Joel Greenberg, a former Florida tax collector and close confidant of Florida Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz, formally pleaded guilty on Monday morning to 6 federal charges in a court hearing, admitting to a federal judge that he had knowingly solicited and paid a minor for sex. The guilty plea comes after he struck a deal with federal prosecutors to avoid some of the other 33 federal charges he'd faced. that range from identity theft to fraud and bribery allegations. As part of the plea, Greenberg has agreed to give substantial assistance to prosecutors as part of their sprawling investigation. Federal investigators are still examining whether Gates broke federal sex trafficking, prostitution, and public corruption laws and whether he had sex with a minor. Gates has not been charged and denies any wrongdoing. After today's hearing, Greenberg's lawyer, Fritz Scheller, spoke with reporters outside the building in Orlando. Scheller was asked about a statement that he had made a month ago during another hearing when he said that Gates should not be feeling very comfortable right now.
Last time we talked, there was I had a certain agenda, which I accomplished. This time, I will leave that up to Matt Gaetz' attorneys to answer and to Matt Gaetz.
Can you ask you a statement of facts here? It says that Greenberg paid her to engage in commercial sex acts with him and others. Who could those others be?
I'm not going to answer that.
How many
others? Can you tell us?
Pardon?
Go ahead.
How many others?
I'm sorry? I'm sorry. I didn't hear you. I wasn't ignoring you. I'm not going to answer that question.
Fritz Scheller not answering many questions. He's the attorney for Joel Greenberg outside the federal courthouse in Orlando, Florida, after today's guilty plea. Congressman Matt Gaetz, again, he has not been charged with anything, but he is being investigated by the U.S. House of Representatives. On Sunday, told the Ohio Political Summit, "I'm being falsely accused of exchanging money for naughty favors." Thanks for joining us on Washington Today. It's available as a podcast. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts and download the free C-SPAN Radio app. I hope you have a good evening.